Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
The man known to history as King Edward VIII of the United Kingdom and Emperor of India was born on the 23rd of June 1894 at White Lodge, Richmond Park, in Surrey, England. His father was George, the eldest son of Edward, Prince of Wales, the son and heir of Queen Victoria of Britain. As Victoria was into her mid-70s by the time young Edward was born in 1894, it was clear that her son, the future Edward VII, Prince of Wales, and Edward's grandfather, would soon succeed her. That would place the young Edward as second in line to the throne when it occurred, which it soon did when Victoria died in January 1901. Young Edward's mother was Mary of Teck, the daughter of the Duke of Teck, a senior German. Between them, George and Mary had six children, five boys and one girl. Edward was the eldest, but nearly as consequential as the years went by was the next eldest child, a boy named Albert after his great-grandfather, Victoria's long-deceased husband, over whose death she had never fully recovered. Edward's full name was Edward Albert Christian George Andrew Patrick David, and during his youth he was always referred to within the family as David. Edward was raised from his very youngest years as a future king. He would no doubt not ascend to the throne for several decades, but accidental deaths and illnesses had created a situation where a person in line to the throne in the way Edward was could sometimes ascend at a very young age. His parents were aloof and somewhat gruff in their parenting methods, but it was not a wholly unhappy household. Though Edward grew to become wary of his father's angry outbursts about relatively unimportant issues. He later stated in his memoirs that he felt unloved, and his childhood experiences seemed to have inculcated in him a desire to avoid having children in later life, which he never would. More broadly, Edward became known for having an easy charm in his younger years, which allowed him to mix freely with members of different classes, though his intellect was hardly prodigious. In these younger years, he and his siblings were largely educated at home at York Cottage at Sandringham and at Frogmore near Windsor Castle. As he entered his teenage years, Prince Edward was sent to the Naval College at Osborne on the Isle of Wight. This was a virtually identical training to that which his father had undertaken in his younger years, and which indeed has remained a staple of royal princes ever since. Despite being an heir to the throne, Edward was not overly protected and experienced some bullying in his youth in the Navy. Otherwise, his upbringing was somewhat limited. He was not trained to develop his mind or become a significant scholar in the same way in which his forebears in the 17th or 18th centuries might have been. As a result, he grew up with an intellectually limited worldview. This limited intellectual development was all the more concerning when, in May 1910, with the death of his grandfather, his father became king, and so Edward became heir to the throne at the age of 15. According to tradition, he was soon given the title of Prince of Wales, and despite still being a teenager, was quickly drawn into public life. The occasional appearances at public events were interspersed throughout the early 1910s with studies at the University of Oxford, which his father had decided Edward should attend. However, Edward proved an indifferent student, and when turmoil struck Europe towards the end of his time there, he was glad of the distraction. In the summer of 1914, war descended across Europe. It had been brewing for decades as the rise of a united Germany in the 1870s had destabilized the balance of power in Central Europe and created a major rival to Britain. Other issues, such as rivalry for colonial possessions in Africa and fervent nationalist sentiment in the Balkans, where the Empire of Austria-Hungary and the Russian Empire were rivals to secure control over the collapsing Ottoman Empire, had compounded matters. In the end, it was a regional crisis here. In the summer of 1914, the assassination of the heir to the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, by a Serb nationalist, which lit the match that ignited the war. In the final days of July and the first week of August, Britain, France, and Russia went to war with Germany and the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The major front for the British for the duration of what soon became known as the First World War was in northern France, where the British and French were soon bogged down in attritional trench warfare with the Germans. As part of the effort by the royal family to show solidarity with the millions of British men who were now being conscripted into the military and sent to fight in France, Prince Edward and others were assigned to serve as officers in the army. Edward was commissioned into the Grenadier Guards in the last days of July 1914 and took to military service very well, finding that he enjoyed the camaraderie in ways which his studies had not fulfilled him. However, his wartime experience can hardly be said to have been authentic. Neither Edward nor any other senior members of the royal family or major noble lines could be placed in harm's way where they might be captured or killed. As such, for much of the next 4 years, he was effectively chaperoned by his fellow soldiers in roles across northern France. Some of these were tokenistic, such as when he was sent as a sort of royal ambassador to meet with French generals, but when he appeared to inspect British army camps on the Western Front, it is understood to have genuinely improved morale on the front. Here was a prince and a member of the royal family actively showing up to do his own military service. Indeed, on one or two occasions, despite the extensive precautions taken, Edward did find himself in danger during the war, notably when his chauffeur was killed by exploding artillery and his car crashed in northern France. Moreover, his range of activities extended beyond France, with a visit to the Middle East in 1916 to meet and greet Britain's Australian and New Zealander allies. The war was significant in one other way, which would have a small implication for Edward and his family for decades to come. At the outset of the conflict, the royal family was known as the House of Saxe-Coburg and Gotha. This had been established in 1901 following the succession of King Edward VII, bringing the House of Hanover, which had ruled Britain for nearly two centuries, to an end. However, the House of Saxe-Coburg and Gotha name, which was assigned on account of the extensive links between the British royal family and many of the most senior royal lines within Germany, became problematic in the context of the First World War. It reminded far too many people that the royals had extensive amounts of German blood, and indeed, George V was the first cousin of the German Kaiser Wilhelm II. In particular, when the Germans began dropping bombs on London in 1917 from planes named Gotha bombers, it was clear it was no longer tenable to retain the royal title. Consequently, in July 1917, the royal house's name was changed to that of the House of Windsor, a name adopted owing primarily to the long-standing associations between the English crown and Windsor Castle to the west of London. The war was eventually won in November 1918, and so this name change had little consequence thereafter in practical terms. But the new Windsor name would become associated intimately with Edward in due course. The end of the war opened up the issue of Edward marrying and fathering an heir to secure the line of succession. However, Edward's father, unlike most other previous monarchs, was open to allowing Edward to decide his marital affairs for himself, and the British public were more keen by the late 1910s and 1920s that some form of mutual affection should play a part in the selection of a future queen by the prince. Edward was not in any rush either. Rather, as the bloodshed of the 1910s gave way to the economic boom and social excesses of the 1920s, Edward became a regular attender at London nightclubs and dance halls where an entourage attached themselves to the future king. He also began an affair with Winifred Dudley Ward, who was already married with two small children to William Dudley Ward, the grandson of Lord Esher in the British nobility. Eventually, Ward divorced her husband, and the affair became extremely serious in the 1920s, although Edward did also see several other women intermittently throughout these years. However, the relationship with Ward would never result in marriage, even after she divorced her first husband, and it was eventually ended by Edward in 1934. This penchant for the high life and Edward's complicated love life had created concerns within the government and amongst the royals themselves during the 1920s. Compounding this was what was perceived as Edward's quasi-egalitarian manners and habits. During his time in military service during the war, the prince had become used to trying to find common ground with the rank-and-file soldiers, and he continued his efforts to do so during royal visits abroad to Canada and other regions in the 1920s. His easy manner with ordinary people would be viewed positively in a member of the royal family today, but in the interwar period, nearly a century ago, the royals, senior politicians, and the nobles of the realm looked at this disapprovingly. Moreover, many looked at Edward as a monarch who might try to exercise too much political independence when he became king, rather than a figure who would carry out the ceremonial duties of being monarch, which was effectively what the monarchy had been in England since the early 18th century. Thus, already by the late 1920s, there was growing concern about the prince's behaviour and attitudes within senior political circles, ones which were no doubt expressed in private when King George developed a serious illness which lasted for several months in 1928 and 1929. He recovered and would reign for several more years, but there were worrying signs of a clash between his successor and the political realm in years to come. In the early 1930s, Edward met the woman who would determine the course of the remainder of his life. Wallis Simpson was an American socialite from Pennsylvania who was born as Bessie Wallis Warfield. 2 years Edward's junior, she had grown up in Baltimore, and she and her mother had been supported by wealthy extended family members after her father died during her youth. In 1916, she had married Earl Winfield Spencer Jr., an American Air Force pilot. It was a fractious marriage, and while it lasted over a decade, long before they eventually divorced in 1927, the pair had spent extended periods of time apart. The following year, Wallis married Ernest Simpson, an American by birth, who had developed extended business connections in Britain. As a result of his business dealings, the Simpsons were largely living in England by the early 1930s, where Wallis was moving in high society circles. Much of their social ascent was a mirage, though, and Ernest Simpson's business affairs had run into serious trouble following the Wall Street crash of 1929 and the Great Depression which followed. This undoubtedly placed some strain on his and Wallis's marriage in the early 1930s, around the time that she was first introduced to Prince Edward.
This video is brought to you by Enlisted, the brilliant World War II multiplayer shooter game. Enlisted features hundreds of firearms and specialized weapons, both common weapons and prototypes rarely portrayed in games. The most exciting thing about Enlisted is that it is truly authentic, but keeps gameplay dynamic with players always in the middle of the action. My favorite vehicle was the Panzer IV tank. It made me feel indestructible. And the best feature of Enlisted is the customization. Each soldier is an individual with his own name, skills, and inventory. Also, there is no purchase necessary. Simply follow the link to download and play for free. You will also get a nice bonus when using our link, which gives you 3 days of premium time and several orders for troops and weapons. Play Enlisted on PC, PlayStation 4, PlayStation 5, Xbox One, Xbox Series X, and Series S. Follow the link to download the game and get your exclusive bonus now. See you in the battle.
...1934 was a pivotal year in the development of the relationship between the Prince and Wallace Simpson. That year, he decided to end his sporadic affairs with Frieda Dudley Ward and other mistresses such as Lady Furness. Curiously enough, his fascination with Mrs. Simpson seems to have derived from her being the more dominant individual within the relationship. Edward maintained a childlike personality throughout his adult life, and Simpson, as so many reports of the mid-1930s would assert, seemed to have the prince completely under her thumb. For his part, Edward was clearly besotted by her, and it seems evident that by 1934 or 1935, he had determined to marry her and for Simpson to become queen consort one day. There were early signs that this would not prove possible, though. When Edward introduced his American lover to his father and mother, they were not impressed, and indeed, there were even special branch police assigned to monitor the couple's movements from 1935 onwards. There were two major issues at hand, the first being the fact that Simpson was a divorcee, and on religious and moral grounds it would be disapproved of for the future King of England to marry such a woman and for her to become queen. Simpson's American background and reports that she had excessive influence over Edward were also paramount in the minds of worried observers in the mid-1930s. The question of who would become queen consort became a pressing one before too long. On the 20th of January 1936, at 70 years of age, King George V died, and Edward was proclaimed as King Edward VIII the following day. At first, there were positive signs. George V had been an ill man for many years, and his chronic respiratory problems had often taken from his ability to serve as monarch. Moreover, he was perceived in the public eye as an antiquated figure, one who belonged more to the world of the late 19th century than the new emerging world of the interwar period. This public enthusiasm for a new monarch after a long reign ends was not an entirely unusual feature of British political life, but in Edward's case, it would prove unfounded. The new king seems to have given almost no thought to how he would reign when he succeeded his father. Nevertheless, it quickly became clear that Edward was the polar opposite of his father inasmuch as he had very little interest in the actual affairs of state. Ministers would present him with documents and state papers, which he would give almost no attention to. Rather, he seemed to be content to carry on his life much as he had before, including maintaining an active social schedule in London. Within weeks, many at Westminster and elsewhere were troubled by what they saw. Edward's distracted nature was all the more worrying because when George V died, it was a moment of some considerable difficulty in world politics. The legacy of the First World War was immense. In Eastern Europe, the Russian Revolution had broken out in 1917 and resulted, after many years of civil war, in the emergence of the Soviet Union as a major world power, one which was ideologically opposed to nations like Britain. In the Far East, the Empire of Japan was ascendant as the dominant power there, and several years earlier, in 1931, had begun aggressively expanding on the Asian mainland by conquering the Chinese province of Manchuria. In Western Europe, Spain was about to descend into a vicious civil war after years of instability, whilst elsewhere on the continent, fascist regimes and authoritarian governments had seized power in countries like Italy, Austria, and Hungary. Compounding the growth of extremist politics was the economic crisis, which began in 1929 with the Wall Street crash and which resulted in years of profound economic depression in the early 1930s. In this landscape, Britain was a bastion of relative stability. Edward's job as king would be to try to maintain this and Britain's empire in India and Africa. However, of all the problems which were confronting Europe, none was as great as that posed by Germany. The country had been left demoralized and destabilized by the terms of the Treaty of Versailles, which had been imposed on the country by Britain and France in 1919. This reassigned large amounts of formerly German territory to its neighbors and imposed huge financial reparations on the country, while also heavily restricting the size of its military. Nevertheless, after several years of crisis in the late 1910s and early 1920s, the German Republic had entered a period of relative stability in the mid-1920s and was the cultural center of the continent. But the economic crisis of the late 1920s and early 1930s hit Germany particularly badly. As it did, an extremist party, the National Socialist German Workers' Party, or Nazis, led by Adolf Hitler, managed to claim power early in 1933 after years of electoral gains. They soon turned Germany into a one-party dictatorship and, in the 12 months prior to Edward's accession, had begun aggressively rearming in contravention of the Treaty of Versailles. One might have expected that Edward's reign would be characterized by opposition to Nazi aggression, but events were quickly to ensure that the reign was brief and Edward was soon cozying up to the Germans in ways which have cast a shadow over his entire life ever since. Edward was known to sympathize with elements of the Nazi regime in Germany, an issue which would create untold controversy before too long. But the more pressing issue in the first months of his reign was that of his relationship with Mrs. Simpson. At first, it was not clear how much difficulty this would create. But when the foreign newspapers began covering the new king's holiday on a yacht on the Mediterranean with Simpson shortly into his reign, unease began to emerge amongst government ministers in London. When it then became clear that Wallace Simpson was in the latter stages of finalizing the divorce from her second husband, the government of Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin had to begin to take a stance on matters. Baldwin was not naturally inclined to be interventionist on matters of this kind. He was often seen to be a vacillating prime minister who delayed making major decisions to an excessive degree. Additionally, he personally liked Edward and was not overly enthusiastic about interceding with him on the matter of his possible marriage. He prevaricated for as long as possible, but eventually he requested to see the king on the 20th of October 1936, possibly on account of having learned some days beforehand of Wallace's intentions to finally divorce her long-suffering husband. When they met on the 20th of October, Baldwin informed the king that an embargo on press reports of the new monarch, which was legally enforced at the time following a new coronation, was about to expire. Once it was, it would become impossible to prevent the newspapers and the wider public speculating massively on the king's relationship with Mrs. Simpson and whether he intended to marry her after she divorced. Accordingly, he advised the king that Wallace should avoid finalizing her divorce in the immediate term and absent herself from Britain for some time until the matter could be more thoroughly debated by all the relevant parties. The king fobbed Baldwin off, arguing that Wallace's marital status was a private matter, when clearly her divorce would have profound implications for British public life if she then went on to marry the king. Things spiraled from there. A week later, on the 27th of October, Wallace obtained her divorce, though she would not be free to marry again for over 6 months, given the laws at the time. A week later, Edward, who had not yet been crowned as plans were still being made for his coronation, opened a new parliament. Unbeknownst to him, the government had already contacted his brother, the Duke of York, with a view to preparing him for the possibility of succeeding his brother if the issue of the divorce led to him having to abdicate. Baldwin met with the king again on the 16th of November. At this audience, Edward admitted to a senior member of the government for the first time that he intended to marry Wallis the following summer, once it became legally possible to do so. By that time, Baldwin's government had begun canvassing opinions from both within Britain and the Dominion states, which were still ruled as part of the British Empire. These indicated that there would be strong hostility to the idea of a monarch taking as his queen a woman who was twice divorced, primarily on religious and moral grounds. Baldwin was also aware that organizations such as the Church of England would be especially hostile within Britain itself. However, Baldwin was provided with a curious way out by Edward, who asserted that if the government was determined to prevent him from marrying Wallis, he would abdicate rather than spurn her. He had informed his immediate family members of the same by the end of the 18th of November. Thereafter, 2 weeks of inaction largely followed, during which the major development was the emergence of a proposal that a morganatic marriage could be entered into between Edward and Wallis, whereby she would become his wife, but not the Queen Consort. This, however, would have required a parliamentary decree and would open the monarchy up to extensive debate in Parliament, a development which nobody welcomed either within the government or in the royal family. The conclusion to the growing constitutional crisis was swift when it came. Baldwin began consulting the cabinet and the secretaries of the dominions in the last days of November, and by early December it was clear that nobody was in favour of Edward continuing as king if he married Wallis. Moreover, press silence was crumbling by then and discussion of the matter was becoming widespread. On the 3rd of December, Wallis temporarily left for France to avoid overt press speculation. Yet this did little to allay Baldwin's government, who are now insisting that Edward needed to abdicate the throne if he was set on marrying Simpson. This is duly what Edward did a week later, signing the official instrument on the 10th of December, despite being encouraged by several individuals such as Winston Churchill to fight for his rights as king. King Edward VIII abdicated his position as monarch on the 11th of December 1936. At 327 days, it was the shortest reign of any English monarch since the late 15th century. Edward's speech to the nation, in which he declared that he was renouncing his crown of his own volition in order to marry the woman he loved and had not been coerced into his actions by the government, was something of a high point for Edward, one which was perceived as being dignified and statesmanlike. The years that followed would not see a repetition of such behaviour. There remained the final issue of what title the former king and his soon-to-be wife would bear. On the 13th of December 1936, the same day that Edward officially announced his abdication, his brother and successor proposed that Edward and Wallis would henceforth carry the titles of Duke and Duchess of Windsor, the royal family name which had been adopted back in 1917. In tandem, the Duke and Duchess were given extensive financial privileges and a lavish salary and estates. However, the royal family now began a process of cutting off the former king and his new wife. As late as the 1940s, other members of the family and the king himself continued to refer to Wallis coldly as simply Mrs. Simpson. This was despite the fact that Edward and she had married at the Chateau de Condé near Tours in France on the 3rd of June 1937. The nuptials were not attended by any of the royal family, and other than a note of congratulations from Baldwin's government, were largely ignored on an official level in Britain. Moreover, It was in France, where they would spend much of their lives from that time, generally living either in Paris or a country retreat. The rest of the royal family were delighted by this exile, and the general tenor in Britain was that everyone wished to forget the brief kingship of Edward in 1936 and the constitutional crisis which it had aroused. Edward and Wallace settled in Paris and began leading a relatively rich lifestyle based on the funds which Edward had been paid to relinquish his ownership of several royal residences in England as part of the abdication agreement. During this time, he rang his brother, the new king, every few days, often imploring George VI that his wife should be allowed to have the title Her Royal Highness, in recognition of her position as the wife of a former king of Britain. However, this was refused. The concern in London being that Wallace would continue to use such a title at some future date, even if she divorced Edward. Meanwhile, the newlyweds continued to enjoy Paris life, but they appeared to have harbored the view at this stage that this was a temporary exile. They soon received messages from England which put them straight concerning this notion, making it clear that it would be in everyone's best interest if they stayed in Paris and away from Britain. As the extent of the rebuff he was now suffering dawned on Edward, he began concocting ways to carve out a new place in the public life of Europe. While many individuals might have wished to retreat from the public eye as quickly as possible and attempt to lead a quieter life for some time, given the bruising experience of Edward's brief kingship, he and Wallace quickly entered into the most controversial episode of the former king's life. As we have seen, the early 1930s had witnessed the rise of Adolf Hitler and the Nazis to power in Germany. Now, shortly after his abdication, Edward accepted an offer to visit Germany. This must be viewed in context. Many individuals visited Germany in the mid-1930s as they wished to see exactly what was taking place there and how the Nazis had so rapidly overhauled the country and pulled it out of the economic crisis of the early 1930s. For instance, the former British Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, who had been the head of state in Britain from 1916 to 1922, had visited the country in late 1936 as the constitutional crisis concerning Edward was playing out at home. In assessing any of these visits, it is important to remember that many British people in the mid-1930s viewed Hitler as an important bulwark against the development of a communist state in Germany, and secondly, that individuals like Lloyd George did not know when they decided to visit Germany the horrors which the Nazis would unleash across Europe a few short years later. The offer to visit Germany was extended to Edward in the late summer of 1937 from Dr. Robert Ley, the head of the German Labour Front, an organization which had been set up by the Nazis in Germany to replace the trade unions and stymie any socialist agitation in the country. The offer was extended from this body as figures like Edward and Lloyd George the year beforehand were being invited to the country principally to view how Germany had overcome its economic woes and was running its factories through bodies like the Labour Front. Edward accepted, seemingly based on a desire to rejuvenate his profile in the aftermath of his kingship. A tour of the United States was also planned, and he seems to have developed the idea that he could act as an individual who might foster new ideas about how to avoid political conflicts across the Western world like those which had engulfed Spain and cast it into civil war. Essentially, Edward wanted to visit Germany to see how the further spread of communism and radical socialism could be avoided. Thus, by the early autumn of 1937, he had accepted the offer, and news of the impending visit was relayed to the British ambassador in Berlin, George Ogilvy Forbes. The tour commenced on the morning of the 11th of October when the Windsors arrived at Friedrichstrasse station in Berlin. Despite being billed as a private tour rather than a royal visit, the couple were met at the station not just by Robert Ley, but by Joachim von Ribbentrop as well, who was soon to be appointed as the German foreign minister and still held the title of German ambassador to the United Kingdom. The trip thereafter lasted for 12 days down to the 23rd of October. Much of it consisted, as Lloyd George's had the previous year, of visits to German factories and various government installations. These went from the mundane, such as a tour of a light bulb factory, to the sinister, notably a trip to a newly built concentration camp, which the Windsors were admittedly deceived as to its true purpose. Other visits included ones to Hitler Youth Academies and factories belonging to major German companies like Krupp's. The dominant theme throughout was to present an image of efficient German industry with well-run factories, a nation that had returned to work after the economic difficulties of the early 1930s, and happy and enthusiastic workers. There were also considerable efforts made to highlight Britain's cultural closeness to Germany, with the two nations' national anthems being played whenever Edward and Wallace arrived at a factory or academy. The goal, throughout, was to impress on the couple that Germany was a model for how to prevent the spread of radical socialism on the continent and that the Nazis were natural allies of the British. Throughout their visit, the Windsors met with several of the most senior members of the Nazi regime. For instance, on their first evening in Berlin, the couple were brought to dinner at Horscher's, a popular haunt of the Nazi senior leadership in the capital, by von Ribbentrop, along with the German architect and later Minister of Armaments, Albert Speer, and the Minister of Propaganda, Joseph Goebbels, and his wife, Magda. More controversially, Edward and Wallace met Hermann Göring, the head of the newly formed German Air Force and Hitler's second-in-command, at his hunting estate outside Berlin on the 14th of October. This included a meeting in Göring's study where the Nazi minister had a map of Central Europe on the wall, one which depicted Austria as forming part of a Nazi-controlled Greater Germany. Despite the implication that Germany intended to take over an independent neighbor before long, Edward did not raise any objections. When this was combined with news of the Duke and Duchess visiting armaments factories where German tanks, armored vehicles, and submarines were clearly being constructed, and Edward's offering of the Nazi salute to many officials during the trip, it is not difficult to see how concerns arose surrounding it and endured thereafter. If the impression conveyed to contemporaries and to posterity by the Windsors' near 2 week stay in Germany were not bad enough, it culminated with a personal meeting between Hitler and Edward on the 22nd of October. This occurred at the Berghof, the Nazi leader's alpine retreat on the southern border between Germany and Austria. There are varying accounts of the meeting and the subsequent conversation after Wallace joined them later on. For instance, some suggest it was a rather insignificant meeting with social niceties expressed, some vague feelings of amity between the German and British nations swapped, and compliments exchanged, followed by tea. Others, though, have claimed that Edward indicated his active support for Germany's increasingly aggressive foreign policy and Hitler's desire to acquire lands in Austria, Czechoslovakia, and Poland. There certainly is no suggestion that the former king attempted to discourage German expansionism. Finally, when the meeting had concluded, the former king and the German chancellor departed by giving each other the Nazi salute. Unsurprisingly, the issue of what may or may not have been discussed in Germany during the Windsors' visit, especially during Edward's meetings with Hitler, Göring, and others, have aroused considerable controversy. Some have suggested that discussion veered into talk of Edward facilitating an alliance between Germany and Britain as Germany expanded on the continent and prevented a further rise of communism. These theories have been fueled by the fact that the minutes of the meeting between Hitler and Edward on the 22nd of October were subsequently destroyed. What did they contain that warranted their destruction? Other evidence is open to interpretation. For instance, on the final night of their tour, the Windsors were entertained in Munich by Rudolf Hess, Hitler's long-standing private secretary, and his wife Ilse. At one point, Rudolf and Edward disappeared for about an hour, leaving behind their interpreters and all other staff. An hour later, they were found upstairs. Rudolf was allegedly showing Edward his collection of model ships, but was he really? Or was something more sinister being discussed? While there is extensive disagreement amongst historians about the trip, what has been universally accepted by biographers of Edward and historians of the royals in the mid-20th century is that it demonstrated a startling lack of judgment on the former king's part, one which has forever shrouded his life in ignominy. And it didn't just end when the Windsors departed from Germany on the 23rd of October 1937. As we will see, fresh rumours and concerns abounded during the Second World War, ones which Edward and Wallace did nothing to dispel. Following their trip to Germany, Edward and Wallace returned to Paris, where they rented a mansion on the Boulevard Suchet, in which they lived in the late 1930s. As they were settling there, the Germans were intensifying their aggression on the world stage. Already, during their visit to Germany in 1937, Hitler had been applying ever greater pressure on Austria to force it into a political union with Berlin. The Anschluss, creating a greater Germany, was finally achieved in March 1938 in violation of the Versailles Treaty. Within weeks, Hitler was pressing the case for the annexation of the Sudetenland, a part of Western Czechoslovakia with a largely ethnic German population. At a conference in Munich in September 1938, Britain and France caved in to Hitler's demands, but insisted that any further Nazi attempts at expansion at the expense of Germany's neighbours would result in war. Hitler called that bluff in the spring of 1939 when he annexed the rest of Czechoslovakia and the city of Memel in the Baltic States region. However, when German tanks rolled over the border into Poland at the very beginning of September 1939, appeasement could no longer be allowed. Britain and France declared war 2 days later as the Second World War commenced. For the former king and his wife in France, they, like everyone else in the country, must have assumed a German invasion would come soon. However, as the autumn turned into winter and then 1940 dawned with Poland long conquered by the Germans and no westward campaign having occurred, many began to talk of a phony war. The spring robbed Europe of such hopes. In April 1940, the Nazis invaded Denmark and tactically occupied the key cities and towns of Norway. Just weeks later, an invasion of the Low Countries and France was initiated. This action aroused fresh concerns about Edward, who was accused by some British diplomats of having leaked information to Berlin, which had facilitated the German assault on Belgium. The accusation was especially damning when the British Expeditionary Force to France became trapped at the town of Dunkirk in late May as a result of the unexpected success of the German two-pronged assault of Belgium and northeast France. Only a daring amphibious rescue operation prevented hundreds of thousands of British troops from either being obliterated or captured. The French, though, were not so lucky. And on the 14th of June 1940, Paris was occupied by the Nazis. The city, and France in general, would remain under German control for the next 4 years. Notwithstanding their earlier friendliness towards the Nazis, the Duke and Duchess were the targets of a conspiracy by Hitler and the Nazi paramilitary organization, the SS, in the summer of 1940. The goal of what was codenamed Operation Willy was to kidnap the Windsors, who had left Paris when France was invaded in May 1940, heading south to Biarritz and then journeying over the border into Spain, with the ultimate goal of reaching Portugal. Operation Willy was conceived while they were travelling through Spain, which, under the fascist dictatorship of General Francisco Franco, was friendly towards Hitler's government. The idea was that the Duke would be kidnapped, brought to Germany, and then his alleged pro-German inclinations would be fostered with a view to re-establishing him as King of England, following the German defeat of Britain in the war. By the time plans were at an advanced stage, the Windsors had already crossed into Portugal and were living in Lisbon by the first days of July 1940. At this juncture, a new plan was settled on, whereby Edward would be tricked into crossing back into Spain and detained there. But even Walter Schellenberg, the SS official who was placed in charge of the operation and who subsequently became the head of Nazi foreign intelligence, later conceded that the plan was ludicrous. Operation Willy was never brought to fruition, but the arrival of the Windsors in Lisbon and the ever-present lack of tact displayed by Edward and Wallace on their arrival there opened them up to further charges of engaging in traitorous activity, ones which, like their visit to Germany in 1937, have created long-lasting suspicions which have never been entirely resolved. The Windsors had apparently elected to make their way to Spain and Portugal in May 1940 owing to anxieties about their diminished status in Britain and certain tax burdens which would fall on them if they returned home. Back in Britain, this failure to return to England looked very bad, and the new Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, looked at it particularly disapprovingly. Matters only became more suspicious when the Windsors arrived in Portugal and promptly accepted an offer to stay in the home of Ricardo Espirito Santo, a Portuguese banker who had extensive business connections in Germany and who was suspected of having sufficient contacts with Hitler and the Nazis that MI6, the British intelligence service, had opened a file on him. Perhaps Edward and Wallace were unaware of this, but it seems unlikely, and in accepting the offer to stay with Santo, the former king was either involved in talks with Santo or else was acting in an incredibly irresponsible manner, one which almost guaranteed that his loyalty would be questioned. Yet, there was worse still. Recent research has revealed that while he was in Portugal, Edward promoted the idea through Ricardo Espirito Santo that the Nazis should, quote, bomb Britain into peace. Edward here was apparently proposing that the Nazis should adopt a strategy of aerial bombing over England and London, in particular, in order to force the British government into surrendering without the necessity of a land invasion. This was effectively the strategy which the Germans adopted in the summer of 1940, leading to the Blitz of London and England for the next year. This recent study has highlighted how Edward had proposed the Blitz while in Portugal, and that the same advice was then conveyed to the Nazi government in Berlin by the German ambassador in Lisbon. It is possible that Edward viewed this as the lesser of two evils compared to a land invasion, but there is still absolutely no denying that coming from a member of the royal family, this advice constituted treason of the highest kind. In the months that followed, tens of thousands of bombs were dropped on Britain, leading to approximately 40,000 civilian deaths. In September and October 1940 alone, London was bombed almost every single night. Edward seemingly advocated that Berlin should adopt this strategy in order to force the country into surrendering and to make him King of Britain again in the aftermath of the capitulation. Edward's possible duplicity while in Lisbon did not end along with his brief sojourn in Portugal. As soon as he and Wallace arrived there, Churchill had taken steps to remove Edward from continental Europe while also avoiding bringing him back to Britain. He could not have the Duke residing on the continent and possibly falling into Nazi hands. The possibility that he would collude with the Nazis and potentially work out a deal to be made King of England once again was now too great. At the same time, Edward's actions in fleeing to Portugal and in visiting Germany back in 1937 made him a liability if he were to be brought back to England. Accordingly, Churchill had a statement sent to Lisbon that Edward had been appointed as the new governor of the Bahamas, the British island colony north of Cuba. Edward eventually accepted the position, and he and Wallace departed from Portugal on the steamship, the Excalibur, on the 1st of August 1940. However, 2 weeks after leaving Portugal, Edward engaged in possibly his most incriminating behavior yet. On the 15th of August, he sent a telegram to Espirito Santo, his and Wallace's Portuguese host, asking him to send word as soon as he needed to act. When this document was made public in 1957, Edward dismissed the significance of it. But here would seem to be evidence that Edward wanted to be updated by a known German agent of any developments which might lead to him returning to Europe to be installed as a puppet king of England if Germany defeated Britain in the war. Suspicions about Edward and his wife's actions over the past several years were still considerable enough that when the couple decided to visit the United States from the Bahamas in the spring of 1941, they were monitored by the Federal Bureau of Investigation at the behest of President Franklin D. Roosevelt. J. Edgar Hoover's FBI was acting on information supplied by a German monk living in the U.S., who claimed to have information that Wallace Simpson had been the lover of Joachim von Ribbentrop, the German foreign minister, back in 1936 when he had served as the Nazi ambassador to Britain. Suspicions were also aroused by a different English informant who claimed that Edward had made an arrangement with Hermann Göring that if the war ended in German victory, Göring would then attempt to overthrow Hitler and subsequently install Edward as King of England. How much of any of this was based on solid information, and how much was just the wild imaginings of FBI informants is very difficult to know, but it is indicative of the concern which attached itself to Edward and Wallace during the war years that they were shadowed by FBI agents during this first visit to Florida from the Bahamas in 1941, and again on several further occasions after the US entered the war in December 1941. We may never be able to disentangle fact from fiction when it comes to Edward's dealings with the Nazis, but we can be sure of one thing. Any plot which he might have been engaged in did not materialize. Instead, Edward and Wallace spent the period from the autumn of 1940 through to the end of the war in 1945 largely ensconced in the Bahamas, a region which Edward dismissively referred to as a third-rate colony. He was contemptuous of the natives, whom he viewed as racially inferior to their colonial overlords, and as a consequence, might have been the worst individual imaginable to have been charged with quietening serious riots over low wages across the islands, which occurred in the summer of 1942. However, Edward handled these diplomatically and, as governor of the island, introduced a policy of poor relief and public works to try to both develop the islands and assuage ill will against Crown rule. Nevertheless, he and Wallace were eager to leave what they considered to be a colonial backwater to which they had been banished, and in mid-March 1945, months before the war ended, the former king resigned his commission as governor of the island archipelago. While Edward and Wallace spent their time in the Bahamas and being trailed in the US by FBI agents, the war effort began to turn against the Germans. Hitler had decided to suspend efforts to conquer Britain late in 1940 and instead turned his attention towards the Soviet Union. A massive invasion, the largest in the history of warfare, was initiated in the summer of 1941. That winter, the German Third Reich reached its greatest extent as German troops reached Moscow and Leningrad. But they failed to take the cities, and by 1942, Russian resistance had turned the war into stalemate on the Eastern Front. Thereafter, Germany's position collapsed gradually as resources ran out, The US entry into the war late in 1941 began to have an impact, and the infinitely superior manpower of the Soviet Union became the deciding factor on the Eastern Front. By the summer of 1943, the Russians were pushing the Germans back towards Poland and Ukraine, and the Western Allies successfully opened a new front in southern Italy. By the time the Western Front was opened in the summer of 1944 by the Western Allies in France, it was really a matter of who would reach Berlin first, the Soviets from the east or the British and Americans from the west. In the end, it was the Russians, with the Western Allies occupying Western and Southern Germany. The war came to an end in early May 1945, days after Hitler killed himself in Berlin. In the immediate aftermath of the war, despite the many unanswered questions which still hung over Edward's conduct both in the years leading up to the war and during it, he was not overtly criticized within the British press. Nevertheless, there was a clear desire for both he and Wallace to resume the arrangement which had been in place in the late 1930s. They would return to France and live there, rather than in Britain, where their presence could be problematic. However, even when they had settled again in Paris, as Europe was being rebuilt, another issue arose which allowed Edward to begin scheming once again. His brother, King George VI, was suffering ill health at a relatively young age owing to his chronic smoking. The possibility of his having to step aside or dying was already acute by the mid-1940s. From afar, Edward engaged in a correspondence with individuals in England in which he suggested that he could return to Britain and potentially serve as a regent for his young niece, Princess Elizabeth, whom he claimed would otherwise fall under the influence of her Mountbatten in-laws. The scheme never came to anything, and George would, in any event, live on until 1952, by which time Elizabeth was well into her mid-twenties. But it is indicative of the ceaselessly ambitious conniving of Edward that even after the ignominy which followed him in the aftermath of the war had developed, he continued to assess ways of re-entering British public life. Notably, he did not attend Elizabeth's coronation, but watched it on television from Paris. It was, though, to be the last of his forays in this regard. When Elizabeth did succeed and began a long and prosperous reign in 1952, her uncle and his wife resigned themselves to life in Paris. There they became a sort of curious celebrity couple, the former King of Britain and his American wife, who had done so much to unsettle Britain's politics before the war. They hobnobbed with British expats in the city and engaged in France's post-war café society. Meanwhile, Edward supplemented the extensive income they had and financial perks which persisted from the arrangement reached with the British government in the late 1930s by engaging in illegal currency trading. He also took up his pen to author A King's Story, a memoir which was published in 1951 and set out his opposition to the species of liberal politics which were dominating the post-war world in Western Europe and North America. It was also the first book by a former or indeed sitting King of England to have been published since 1688. Furthermore, as the early 1950s turned into the mid to late 1950s, they began to visit the United States more frequently, socializing with politicians and celebrities and even visiting the White House during the presidency of Dwight Eisenhower. As such, they became a celebrity couple of sorts, albeit a curious one, but one which seemed to pose no further danger to the stability of public life back home in Britain. Wallace and Edward's relationship remained something of a mystery to many who commentated on it in the post-war period. Several who had spent time with them during the 1950s noted that they seemed very distant from one another, rarely addressing things to the other directly. It was a strange dynamic for a couple whose relationship had apparently been so intense 20 years earlier that Edward was willing to give up the crown for her. For a while in the mid-1960s, they returned to Britain and spent a considerable amount of time there attending various royal events, which occurred from 1965 onwards, notably the funeral of Princess Marina of Kent, who was Edward's sister-in-law through her marriage to his brother, who somewhat confusingly was also known as George, the same name as his brother, the King, who had adopted George as his regnal name, but had been christened Albert. Edward, like Marina, was not far away from the grave himself. By now, in his early 70s, he was facing a mounting number of health problems, most related to his chronic smoking. In between attending events in Britain in the mid-1960s, he regularly flew to America to attend doctors there and had a number of different surgical procedures carried out, notably to relieve his coronary problems. Eventually, the prince's lifetime smoking habit caught up with him. In the early 1970s, throat cancer was diagnosed. It was inoperable and terminal. By this time, he and Wallace had re-ensconced themselves in Paris. But though the former king did not have long left to live, he was able to receive a visit from his niece, Queen Elizabeth II, who fortuitously was on a state visit to France right around that time. Edward died on the 28th of May 1972 in Paris. His body was quickly removed to England, where it lay in state at St. George's Chapel at Windsor Castle rather than at Westminster Hall. Somewhat surprisingly, a large percentage of the British public filed by in the days that followed to pay their last respects to the king who had briefly ruled 3.5 decades earlier. The funeral service was held on the 5th of June in the presence of Queen Elizabeth, the royal family, and Wallace Simpson. Thereafter, he was buried at the Royal Mausoleum at Frogmore. This was perhaps surprising, as there had been considerable speculation over the years as to where in Britain, if at all, Edward would be buried. In death, as in life, the former king was a subject of political intrigue. Edward's widow did not have a good life after his passing. Wallace continued to live in France and was financially supported by her late husband's estate and an allowance from Queen Elizabeth. But her health was declining, and by the late 1970s, she was developing advanced dementia. She was also increasingly frail and prone to falling over, resulting in her breaking her hip twice, while from 1980 onwards, she lost the ability to speak. Thus, her later years were spent largely housebound and with her mental faculties sharply deteriorating. To compound matters, she was being taken advantage of by her French lawyer, Suzanne Blum, who assumed power of attorney for the increasingly incapacitated Wallace. Blum used her position to exploit Simpson financially. Eventually, Wallace died in Paris on the 24th of April 1986 at 89 years of age. Her funeral was held a few days later at St. George's Chapel at Windsor Castle. Her marriage to Edward, which had faced so many difficulties and aroused many different controversies, had survived the distance despite these adversities, and she was interred next to him near Windsor Castle. King Edward VIII was one of the most controversial figures in modern British public life. In 1936, he ascended to the throne of Britain and as Emperor of India when he was still a bachelor in his early 40s. However, while unmarried and without an heir, he was still an individual who had a varied love life. And that was the problem. Not only was the new king known for his extensive social life as Prince of Wales in the 1920s and 1930s, but he was also a figure of widespread gossip on account of his numerous dalliances with married women. One of these was problematic from the start of his brief reign. By 1934, Edward had become besotted with Wallace Simpson, an American who had already divorced once and who would need to do so again in order to marry Edward. When it became clear that that is exactly what the pair intended, it became a matter of national controversy. It has been widely debated ever since whether the issue of Simpson being a multiple divorcee was the real reason for Edward being forced to abdicate at the end of 1936, or if he was simply unpopular within political and social circles, and Simpson was used as a means to force him out in favour of the much more respectable George VI. Whatever the reason, the end product was the same. Edward abdicated, making him the shortest reigning monarch in nearly five centuries. Had matters rested there, we might look on Edward today as a sympathetic character, one who had the crown stolen from him owing to antiquated views on religion and marital morality which pertained in the 1930s. But what followed tarnished his reputation irreparably. In the autumn of 1937, Edward, who had always harboured sympathies towards the Nazi regime which had emerged in Germany in 1933, undertook a tour of the country, one in which he met with such odious characters as Hermann Göring, Joseph Goebbels, and finally Adolf Hitler himself. There is no doubt Edward was in favour of fascism as a bulwark against socialism in Europe. What conspiracies might have been plotted in 1937 is unclear, but we do know that in 1940, when the Nazis quickly conquered France, Edward and Wallace's adopted home, the couple were involved with Nazi agents across Western Europe in the months that followed. Was Edward plotting to return as King of Britain in a Nazi-dominated Europe? We cannot be sure. But what is perfectly clear is that in acting in the way in which he did and opening himself up to the aspersions which he did, Edward forever tarnished himself as the possible traitor king. What do you think of King Edward VIII? Do you think he was conspiring as blatantly with Adolf Hitler and the German Nazi Party as many believed? Or was he simply somebody who liked to arouse controversy? Please let us know in the comments section. And in the meantime, thank you very much for watching.
There is no purchase necessary. Simply follow the link to download and play Enlisted for free. Play Enlisted on PC, PlayStation 4, PlayStation 5, Xbox One and Xbox Series X and Series S. Follow the link to download the game and get your exclusive bonus now. See you in the battle.
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.